Each year in sports, records are shattered and championships are won. But the highly paid analysts get to tell you what to think about it. Who's listening to us, the fans?
This is Talk Back, where real fans get to express their own opinions and engage in heated debates about the world of sports as we see it. Welcome to the show. It's time for another edition of Talk Back. This time we are NFL free. Justin, it's going to feel a little odd not to talk any football this week, so I think we'll throw that into the lightning round maybe at the end. But this week's episode is all about the NBA and all about NASCAR back on the track. I know you watched on Sunday afternoon. What did you think, just real briefly, because we want to get into it in segment two, but Justin, did you like what you saw on the track at Daytona?
When they actually got to racing, yeah, I liked it. Didn't like that parade lap they did sort of through the middle and towards the end of the race. But from what I saw, I think the 500 could be a very exciting race coming up on this Sunday.
I'd have to agree. So in segment two, it's going to be all about NASCAR. But we've got to hit segment one with NBA basketball. As we talked about last week in the show, we knew that the trade deadline was coming. Some big moves were going to happen. We just didn't think they were going to be as big as they ended up being. So Justin and I had a lot of conversations over the weekend, and we knew segment one had to be all about the NBA. And yeah, it's going to have to be all about Isaiah Thomas, LeBron James, the Cavaliers, the Lakers. How does this all impact the league? So right after this, it's going to be NBA basketball. Justin will lead the way, and we're going to get fired up.
The NBA trade deadline came and passed on Thursday, and we spent a good portion last week, Eric, in segment two, just talking about basically the state of the NBA and how there were so many teams with salary cap issues and these bloated contracts that needed to come off the books. We didn't think there were going to be many big names that got moved, especially once the Blake Griffin deal went down several weeks ago. But one thing that we had talked about was the fact that the Cavaliers had some massive issues. You talked about specifically last week that Isaiah Thomas may need to go, that the Cavaliers roster may need a shakeup, that it may start with Isaiah Thomas. I know on Thursday you were pretty actively tweeting that you hoped the Cavaliers could make amends for the mess that they had made with the trade. And lo and behold, 12 noon or so rolls around, and the very busy Adrian Wojnarowski starts putting out tweets that Isaiah Thomas, along with Channing Frye and the Cavaliers' first-round pick in this upcoming draft, had gotten shipped to the Lakers in exchange for guard Jordan Clarkson and forward Larry Nance. Basically, the Cavaliers sort of dominated the day. They were the busiest teams. They also acquired George Hill and Rodney Hood. They shipped out Jay Crowder, Amon Shumpert, among others. They also sent Dwayne Wade back to the Miami Heat in exchange for a draft pick, I think, in about 2045 or something, some second-round pick in 10 years from now, it seemed like. But obviously, there was a huge turnover. 40% of the roster for the Cavs got turned over on Thursday. But obviously, Eric, the big name, Isaiah Thomas, gone. You didn't like that deal in the first place. We talked about that back in the summer when this deal went down. You were not a fan of the deal. I was. I liked Isaiah Thomas. Didn't realize what all was going on behind the scenes there. But let's start with this, Eric, just on the court. Why didn't this move with Isaiah Thomas work?
If we're strictly talking about on the court, I'd have to look at Isaiah Thomas and his career. We're talking about a 5'9" guard out of the University of Washington. We're talking about an individual who was the 60th pick in the 2011 draft and a guy who showed potential. So he starts his career in Sacramento, then moves from Phoenix, where he spent half of a season in Phoenix, and then goes to Boston. And then his career really took off in Boston, finalized by the year prior to this one, where they made a fantastic run into the playoffs. And we saw a person, Isaiah Thomas, dealing with a lot of personal tragedy and devastation and how he persevered through those playoffs. He earned a lot of respect because of the numbers he put up and the things that he was dealing with. So now you ask me, why didn't it work out in Cleveland? First of all, I think you've got this injury issue that potentially lingered on more than maybe the Cavs thought it would. I believe when they did this trade, and I could be completely wrong, I'm not a Cavs insider, I think when they did this trade, when you're trading away a guy like Kyrie Irving, who you know, at least experientially, is a very good player and has proven and delivered a championship along with LeBron 2 years ago, you're hoping that what you get in return is going to show up on the floor in a fair value to what you gave away. Isaiah Thomas, when he finally did return, and now Justin, you said there are going to be growing pains. I get that. But what we saw on the floor from Isaiah Thomas to me were not growing pains. When I see a guard who was, for his career, shooting 45% in Sacramento and 43% in Phoenix and Boston, and then comes to Cleveland and through 15 games is shooting basically 10% lower. He was right around the 35 to 36% range. His points per game were way down compared to what he had done the year before in Boston. His rebounds, his assists were all down. Now, I realize 15 games is a pretty small sample size, but you're talking about a team, the Cavs, who are in a pressure cooker because they've got LeBron James and they've got championship aspirations, and anything less than that is to be considered a failure for that organization. Here's my problem. When you give up Kyrie, you get these other pieces. We can maybe discuss Jay Crowder later, but that's really not a big aspect of this. We're talking about Isaiah Thomas. You have a guy who comes in and performs after an injury the way he did. I think it's to be considered nothing but a huge disappointment. And so I was growing frustrated very quickly. And my guy, LeBron, he was clearly in the last week or two showing, even publicly, some pretty tremendous frustration. And Justin, I think that's where we start to differ on this, is how LeBron handles things, how Isaiah handles things, how the team as a whole starts to handle things, and it starts to get heated up a little bit.
Well, definitely. I mean, the play of Isaiah, and I thought, looking back, of, okay, if he's not ready, which it seemed to be clearly he wasn't, why did the team rush him back? Because I agree with what you said. He wasn't healthy. He didn't look like the same player. He didn't have any pop, any explosion. You could tell he didn't have his legs. He was shooting terribly from the floor. He was pressing. He was taking bad shots. And it was leading to more and more frustration with among the Cavaliers team. And it almost kind of reminds me, Eric, of like Tiger Woods, where he had all this rash of injuries. You'd watch him on the practice range. You'd watch him in practice rounds. You'd watch him on these simulator videos, and he looked great. And he got into competition, and it was just different. And it felt like with Isaiah, whatever they were seeing in practice that felt like he was going to be ready never translated onto the court for them. And then when you look at the schedule that they played with Isaiah, it was pretty much a no margin for error type schedule. Portland, Toronto, two games versus Minnesota. They had the Warriors, the Thunder, the Spurs, Pacers, two versus the Pistons, the Heat, and Rockets, all teams in playoff contention. If you look at the games prior to that, they had two versus the Hawks, the Grizzlies, two versus the Bulls, two versus the Kings, Lakers, two versus the Jazz. It was a much easier schedule at that point. And even prior to the five games before Isaiah came back, the Cavs were only 1-4. So there was already issues within the Cavs, within their defense. You bring Isaiah back. He's not playing well. He's shooting ineffectively. All of a sudden now you start to see LeBron start to grow frustrated. He starts to play, as Brian Windhorst talked about, the most disinterested, dispirited basketball he's ever seen him play, and he's been covering since he was 15 years old. It just matriculated into this growing sense that the Cavaliers were going to have to do something. We had talked about Isaiah potentially being moved for two shows, that there were rumors out there and that it just wasn't working. And Eric, I talked to you about it because I was stuck in a hotel on Wednesday night. I watched the entire Cavaliers-Timberwolves game, and I felt that was the best I had seen LeBron play, the most engaged I had seen him play, really almost all season. And it almost seemed like he knew something was in the works, that Isaiah was going to move on. Because even after that game, when he hits the game winner over Butler, he's celebrating pretty much with everyone but Isaiah Thomas. Isaiah Thomas is like trying to tug at the back of his jersey and like, hey, look at me. I want some love. I want some dap. And LeBron really wanted nothing seemingly to do with him. You could tell right then there was definitely issues. ESPN was reporting there was chemistry issues, that basically the team didn't like each other. Now we get to sort of the next phase of this, where it didn't work on the court and it started to then move into the locker room. It almost was just like a disease that was going through this team. The joy was sucked out of the locker room. There started to become comments. Obviously, LeBron was frustrated. Ty Lue was frustrated. IT starts to speak out. I know that's what got to you and frustrated you with some of Isaiah's comments publicly about the team.
Most certainly. I was pretty harsh with Isaiah Thomas on Twitter. I'll read you one of my tweets. I said, I've said on Talk Back Fan Talk that King James is to blame for a lot of the Cavs' bad contracts. Certainly Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, the fact that they're on the hook for a lot of money in those bad deals. But Dan Gilbert needs to accept a huge share of blame as well. He can start by making amends by trading Isaiah Thomas, and then I put in capital letters, now. He has been a disease ravaging through the team. Now, that tweet didn't hit a lot of people real well. And Justin, I think, you know, I think you took exception to that a little bit too, because Isaiah is not known around the league as a bad guy. And so when I use the word disease, or I say he's ravaging through the team, that's pretty stark language. And I think it's only fair that people say, okay, hold on a second, Eric, let's diagnose that and say, if you're going to call him out on that, what is your point? Justin, I'll let you know my point and I'll let you respond. I think you have a guy who, in his own mind, has mentally risen himself up to a top five player in the league due to his position in the MVP voting last year. And so I think that's playing in his mind that, well, I'm not going to come here to Cleveland and play second fiddle to LeBron. The problem is he's not backing that up with his stats on the floor. And so when you have only a 15 game, like I said, small sample size, quite frankly, you suck on the floor. You're one of the worst players in the NBA over that 15 games. Other than maybe you could say LeBron James if you're looking at plus minuses, although I have an argument about that as well. But then you start being outspoken. You start saying, well, this about this and this about my coach and this about Kevin Love and this about, and you start to hear these things. To me, Justin, I say, Isaiah, you haven't earned that right to come in here after 15 games on the floor and half a season recovering from injury to start ripping through the Cavs like this. Now, I will say this, what we're finding out after the trade is that other players probably were in the same boat as far as questioning the system or possibly even questioning just the gel of the overall team. I don't want to go as far as to say LeBron's leadership because, look, LeBron is a certain kind of leader, and if you play with LeBron, you know what you're getting into. I realize Isaiah didn't choose that because he was traded from Boston, but there's an attitude there that Isaiah had that really rubbed me the wrong way, which is I'm a top five point guard in this league, and so I'm not playing second fiddle to LeBron. I've played 15 games. Yeah, my numbers suck, but here's what I think the problem is, and here's what I think about Kevin Love, and here's what I think about Ty Lue. Justin, that's what bothered me, is that I don't feel like he earned that position on the Cavaliers to be rubbing shoulders with LeBron James and calling everybody out.
The part about on the court where he just didn't play well enough maybe to talk, like he should have been focused on his own game, I sort of understand that, especially from someone that pulls for the Cavs and obviously with LeBron. I think from Isaiah Thomas's aspect, he's looking at this coming from a Boston organization that is a very well-run organization. You have Danny Ainge. He's the face of the front office. He's kind of the GM, the guru that's making these deals and wheeling and dealing and has rebuilt his franchise very quickly. Then you have Brad Stevens, who is known throughout the league as one of the best minds out there. People really like to play for him. And he obviously put Isaiah into a position to be very successful as getting him as high as fifth in the MVP voting, averaging almost 30 points a game. And all of a sudden now you're Isaiah Thomas and you come to an organization that, well, there's a power struggle seemingly between LeBron and Dan Gilbert in the front office that doesn't really seem to know who's really running things. Both of them in a power struggle, in a leverage struggle. You've got Tyronn Lue, who has been criticized for being too simplistic offensively and seems to be one LeBron phone call or text away from losing his job. And then you have this kind of mess on the court where guys don't seem to be happy with each other. We had talked about a report came out months ago about LeBron making just the assist pass and really looking for the triple-double and holding the ball longer. You had Dwayne Wade that came out, criticized the first unit at one point early in the year, saying it would be really nice for the second unit to come on the court, not down double digits. So from Isaiah's aspect, like you said, hey, I was fifth in the MVP voting. I should have a voice. If I don't like the way Kevin Love is doing something, that's not the way that I saw things run in Boston. That's not the way things were allowed. And I think some of that frustration then started to boil out into the media. And again, when you start to think about Isaiah, Eric, I know this is one point we talked about where I'd ask you, we had a pretty spirited text conversation back and forth, but it was like you had talked about some of the pressure on LeBron, that creates this sense in him that it's go time all the time and he's always got to be pushing it. But I also look at Isaiah and just looking back at his career where he was, you know, this time last year, he was averaging 30 a game. He was in the MVP talk. He was in the talk for a max deal. He gets kind of oddly fallen on later in the year, hurts the hip. His sister dies unexpectedly. His hip gives out on him in the playoffs. Now there's question of, does Boston really want him? Now they have the number one pick. Markelle Fultz is sitting there. You start to wonder about his future. They trade that pick away. It seems like, okay, Boston is invested into him. Boom, Kyrie Irving comes in. Isaiah's shipped out. He's never gotten a big payday. He's 29. He's hurt, and he's playing like crap. I'm sure he felt pressure, too, of like, this might be my last chance as well. to be on a winning team to get a contract. And I felt like he started to speak out more of either something's going to change or, you know what, they can just move me. And that's what they decided to do.
I think you make some very valid points there. And if you don't mind, I'm going to respond to a few of them because I think it's good conversation pieces. Yeah, we did have a pretty spirited talk because, look, I don't want to be unfair to him as a human being. And I think you make a good point that if he comes from an organization that did things the right way and made a deep playoff run the year before, and he felt his value was at a certain point, then if he comes to an organization and it's just not looking that it's going that well, and there, you know, maybe he's even seeing things with either Love or Wade or Fry or other pieces. Certainly J.R. Smith's shooting percentage is up and down, up and down. You know, you've got Iman Shumpert sometimes is invisible. I understand if he sees those things and wants to call those things out. I think that I'm not sure who leaked them. I'm not sure how that all happens in an organization. I don't think that he's wrong. So if he wants to have those discussions, I think those are good family discussions for inside the Cavs. But here's my response to what you said. It's this notion that, well, I was here and now I'm here. The Cavs aren't at fault for that. This notion that he comes to the Cavs with this big broken heart that I did all this stuff for Boston and I was about to get a big payday and then I get shipped over to Cleveland and now I'm playing second fiddle to LeBron. I'm sorry, Isaiah, but guess what? That's not Cleveland's fault. You should actually be happy with Cleveland for taking you in the deal when there was questions still remaining about your hip. If you want to be pissed off at anyone, be upset with Danny Ainge and the Boston Celtics because the first opportunity that they had to get a better point guard in Kyrie Irving, instead of paying you, they dumped you and took Kyrie and said, so long, sucker. And that's how it happened. When you come into the Cavs, the issue I have is, why isn't your attitude better? I understand you're heartbroken. I understand this isn't where you wanted to be. You wanted that big payday to be the guy in Boston. It didn't happen. But you know what? It's not Cleveland's fault. Cleveland's the one that saved you because they were the one that were there to pick you up off the pavement and take your injured butt to the next level with a guy named LeBron James, who, by the way, has been to 7 straight NBA finals. So either have a good attitude about that or get off the team. So here's what bothers me this week. He goes and has his Lakers debut. Quite frankly, played great. He shot 58% from the floor, 22 points, 6 assists, a rebound or two. Had a great game. Played like Isaiah Thomas of the Boston era. Why is that odd to me? Because it's only 1 week later from him playing absolutely terrible basketball for Cleveland. Here's my issue with that. It starts to speak to attitude. I am questioning if his attitude was really in the right place with the Cavaliers because, oh, now he's with the Lakers. He was even quoted after the game as saying, well, I wanted to bring something to this team. I wanted to bring something to the table. I felt like I got my superpowers back playing on this team. I want to be a role player. I'm happy coming off the bench. I'm happy helping these younger players. I'm sorry, Isaiah. Where was that attitude when you were in Cleveland? That's what is starting to really bug me about this is you can't just pick and choose in a business like basketball. Yeah, you got traded from Boston to Cleveland. Apparently, you didn't want to be there. Now you go to the Lakers and all of a sudden you flip a switch and you're playing great because you have your superpowers back and your attitude is just phenomenal. I'm sorry, but that just kind of proves my point.
There was 5 other guys that got shipped out of town that maybe this wasn't just a LeBron issue. Isaiah had talked about some of the practice habits of the Cavaliers. He had also talked about specifically Tyronn Lue after they were up 22 on the Magic and got beat by 18, that the fact that they just weren't making good adjustments. Now, I don't understand how anyone could say that from a Cavaliers perspective, that is to criticize him and say anything at that point when you get a 40-point swing in a ball game that you're making good adjustments. So I sometimes wonder just how bad that locker room really was because when you ship out that many guys and you have that many strong personalities with Crowder and Wade and Rose and then IT in there as well, I start to wonder just those guys, how much they were sort of dragging everything down where Isaiah was sort of the guy that was out front and talking about it. And I didn't necessarily mean that Isaiah was brokenhearted. I just meant from a standpoint of like, this is the way an organization should be run. This is the way a coach should be running things, how they should be using me. Maybe he felt like they're not doing that for me. Thus, I'm taking all the blame because I look like hell out here on the floor. We suck. We're getting beat every game. I'm getting killed in the media. My stats look the worst, so obviously I'm going to take the brunt of it. I mean, I heard people like Shannon Sharpe saying, like, he's too small to play. He's too small. Did he shrink over the year? He was 5'9 in Boston when he averaged 30 points, and all you media guys were drooling over how much of a warrior he was. And that's where I get irritated with the narrative, and not specifically to you, Eric, but just the media in general of, you know, these guys like Nick Wright and Shannon Sharpe and these guys that just have no objectivity to LeBron. I mean, they make you look like you actually hate LeBron compared to how they kiss his ass. But if this was LeBron fighting back from a seventh-month injury and he was struggling his first 10 games and upset about it, people would say, like, those guys, oh, he's such a warrior. He's fighting through. He wants to win. You know, he just wants to push this team, this organization. And that's where I see, like, sometimes there's a disconnect with a guy like Isaiah where I don't feel like some of his criticism was that harsh. Talking about coaching, that they're not making good adjustments when you give up basically a 40-point swing in the game. Talking about practice habits with a guy like Kevin Love, where maybe he just felt like nobody else was going to step up. And like, how do you go through pregame and shoot around and then you play 3 minutes and then you leave the arena and no one's going to say anything? Maybe he felt like, all right, well, if no one else wants to, I will say something. And then it just seemed like everyone hated each other so much, the whole damn thing just started to fall apart.
I'm going to have to give you that point because, look, I know Colin Cowherd does where Colin was right and where Colin was wrong. So let me do this. Let's do where Eric was right and where Eric was wrong. Where Eric was right is that Isaiah Thomas on the floor didn't look very good. He was ranked pretty low in the NBA out of qualified players over the 15-game stretch that he played. So if you're only looking at that, as I was deeply looking at that, saying, okay, Isaiah, there's a big problem here with your performance, and you're talking way more than a guy should talk with that kind of performance. Now, I don't think you're wrong, Justin, as far as what is going on in that locker room and in that organization. And prior to the trade deadline, I would have pointed a lot more of the finger at, and I did, at Isaiah Thomas. After seeing what they did at the trade line, including letting go of guys like Wade, who you know for a fact LeBron had something to do with him being there. Derrick Rose probably had something in it with LeBron as far as, hey, let's try to get together and do something special, maybe get you one more contract shot with another team. You know, those guys, they talk about stuff like that. Jay Crowder, he's part of the Isaiah deal. We don't really know for sure where he fit in. But Channing Frye fit the mold of one of those veteran players that a LeBron brings in, like a Ray Allen, like a Mike Miller, like those guys to help the team in tough spots. And he wasn't being very effective. Same with Iman Shumpert. I was excited about Iman Shumpert coming over from the Knicks. His performance just continuing to regress and regress and regress. So here's the thing. Where Eric was right is that Isaiah, yes, he was part of the problem. Where Eric was probably wrong is that Isaiah wasn't the source of the problem. Isaiah was identifying the problem vocally out in the media, which made him look like the bad guy. I think publicly and the way that people talk about Isaiah, I think he's actually probably a pretty good guy. So with that being said, where Eric was wrong is that there was a disease in this locker room, but it wasn't just Isaiah. It was a lot of guys, including LeBron. There is part of the disease that LeBron has to own. We could get into that and we could talk about that as far as like bad contracts, like we said, Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, how much they're paid and how much they're dragging that team down versus the performance per dollar you're getting out of those guys. That's a big problem for the Cavs. There's no doubt about it. So where Eric was wrong is the fact that when I see the Cavs not only ship Isaiah Thomas, but then ships, you know, five guys to go along with that. And there's this mass exodus of six players from that team. And the guys they bring in are four, you know, relatively young. I know some of them, you know, George Hill, I think, is in his ninth or 10th year in the league, but he's got energy. He plays defense. You know, he plays a completely different style of ball than a lot of the guys they shipped out. Then you see the first game that those guys, or some of those guys played together. And you see the way that Cleveland had a totally different energy level, including LeBron himself, which, like I said, I think LeBron is partly to blame here. I think you're right then, Justin. I think there is a big organizational problem, and it's possible that this might have fixed it, at least for this year. So, Justin, now let's talk about the rest of this year and beyond, because I know LeBron is praised heavily when things go well. One of the things as a big LeBron James fan that bothers me is how many people will pile on to him when things don't go well. One of the things that was brought up is, hey, LeBron's plus minus is absolutely the worst in his career, second worst in his career over this past month, something like that. And I say, well, Yeah, but statistics can lie sometimes. Justin and I talked about the fact that through the beginning 2 months of the season, in his 15th year in the NBA, LeBron is like on MVP pace here. But we also talked about the fact that he's playing 41 minutes a game, 42 minutes a game. And so just mathematically speaking, if the rest of your team is shooting 38% from the floor, LeBron's not shooting 38% from the floor. But if the rest of your team's shooting 38% of the from the floor, and you yourself are on the floor for 41, 42 minutes out of a 48-minute basketball game, then your plus-minus isn't going to be very good because you're on the floor during long periods of time when you're losing. And so that's a lying stat to me. And so Isaiah, of course, with the minutes he was playing, that's part of his lying stat too. That you can't work that against those guys. Now, over the last few weeks, LeBron was not himself. And I think, Justin, what people see and where people start to say, LeBron is whining. LeBron is, you know, he's just being a baby about stuff. I'm going to have to defend him on that. And I'm going to say, guys, he 15th year in his league, 33 years old. He's giving you all he's got. And yeah, does he have the right to be frustrated at this point with the Cavs, seeing what this roster is doing and saying, guys, we're not losing basketball games by a little bit here. We're getting blown out by the Rockets. We're losing a 20-point lead to the Magic. So do you think that LeBron really wanted to play basketball at this point? I understand both sides of it, I guess, is what I'm saying. So yeah, I'm a LeBron apologist. I'm defending LeBron. But does he play hard when the team is playing hard? Yes, he absolutely does. Does he get whiny and frustrated and stuff when the other four guys on the floor or the other eight guys that are playing that night are, quite frankly, playing awful? Yeah, he does, because he can't be all and do all.
Where we differ at with LeBron is, normally I would say, you know what, you're right. As hard as LeBron plays, he's not missed a game this year. He's averaging 37 minutes a night. He's got every right to complain when the guys around him don't play well or don't play even close to the standard that they should. The problem I have is when the guys on the roster around him are guys that he has put there, or his team or his inside guys have helped put on that team specifically. And that's guys like Tristan Thompson and J.R. Smith, and up until the trade deadline, Amon Shumpert. Those were players that LeBron either wanted the organization to bring in or wanted them to re-sign. And that's not really that bad of a thing to want guys around you that you feel are good players. The problem for me has been that's really basically something that's unheard of is the fact that these guys that are represented by Clutch, which is the agency that LeBron James has funded or has interest in that his guy Rich Paul runs. And when you have a player like Tristan Thompson, who's basically a role player, who's great at his role at being a defensive stopper, you know, rebounding and getting those offensive boards and those extra possessions that you need, that's well and great. But he's not Chris Bosh 2.0. He wasn't a player that had a history of averaging 25 and 12, and you bring him in and think, okay, we can run some plays for him. He can really help us. He's basically a guy that does all the hustle work and gets the garbage points. He gets the putbacks or the lob dunks. He's not getting anything run for him. And when you give him $18 million, you start to hamper what you can put around LeBron James. J.R. Smith, the same way. He's a role player. He's a three-point shooter, and he's a poor to maybe mediocre defender when he's actually engaged within the team, and he's not like dapping someone up on the baseline and letting 45-year-old Jason Terry get a free bunny on him because he's like not even paying attention. Like, that's the J.R. Smith that you don't know from night in, night out who you're going to get. And then you bring in Amon Shumpert, another guy that's a defensive player. Yeah, he's a nice player, but why are you giving him $40 million over 4 years? So right there, you've got half of your cap, really, in three guys that are just role players. And that's all at LeBron kind of pushing for those type of players. This recent deal, I don't know what LeBron had to do with it, but I felt like the Cavaliers got better. And I don't know that it was guys that necessarily maybe LeBron wanted to play with, especially when you think about them shipping Wade out of town. And look, maybe LeBron behind the scenes feels like, look, Wade really wasn't doing anything for us. They were going to reduce his minutes anyways. Let's ship him out. The front office can be the bad guys. I'll just act like, oh man, I can't believe they're going to do this, but we'll send you home.
I think it was on record that they talked about it though.
Yeah.
They were okay with it. They kind of mutually agreed to let him go.
The Cavs went to LeBron and sort of that was reported that they asked him if it was okay. And I'm sure Wade at that point, if he knew his role was going to get reduced, probably was okay with going back, but I think it benefited both of them. Wade was giving a lot to that team. So from that standpoint, that's where I get frustrated with LeBron of like, okay, I understand that you need more playmakers around you, but you have strapped this organization so much that's when I start to get frustrated with this whole, oh, there's distrust with Dan Gilbert. Dan Gilbert just took on $28 million in extra money and has paid as a repeat offender on the luxury tax. He has shown time in, time out that he will pay to get the players around LeBron. Now, all the stuff that happened when LeBron left, yeah, you can't take that back. I mean, if that relationship is completely fractured where they'll never get along, maybe that's just what it is. But I don't think that there's an owner out there that's going to spend more money than Dan Gilbert to try to put the pieces around LeBron. That's where I get frustrated with him, is the players that aren't producing are guys that really have never produced outside of IT. He was the only guy that they brought in that, really, maybe, I don't know how much LeBron had to do with that. I don't know if IT was necessarily a LeBron guy. I can't believe they didn't try to make a play for a LeBron guy like Eric Bledsoe, someone that he has a relationship with, and maybe it would go on better. I feel like that part is on Cleveland, but the fact that LeBron won't commit to the organization and there's always this leverage play, some of those things led to Kyrie Irving basically wanting out of town. And wanting out of town so fast that people, again, like Nick Wright and these guys that get these jobs that just don't even read articles. It just was reported Kyrie threatened to say, if you guys don't trade me, I'm going to have knee surgery and I'll sit out this year and I'm going to do my own leverage play. They had to move it. Did they move it for the right player? Obviously now, hindsight 2020, no. But because of that uncertainty and then some of the other things of little brothering Kyrie and frustrating him, that he sort of forced Kyrie to just want to be out of the team. So the weapon that he had, the best playmaker on the team, one of the best ISO breakdown guys in the league, sort of got ran out of town because he felt like basically he wasn't valued the way LeBron was by the organization. And he didn't know year to year what LeBron was doing. And you look at this team now, before the trade, where they actually got some young pieces, before that, when you looked at them, you go, my God, if LeBron leaves, there's really nothing here but Kevin Love and a bunch of bad contracts. So that's where I get frustrated with LeBron, because I understand his frustration with how hard he plays, but he's put himself in that position at some point, and that's where I feel like he can't complain, especially about the Cavaliers.
I think you make good points on all of those aspects. I think I just approach it from a little bit of a different angle, which is not to say that you're wrong or that what you're saying about that is wrong, because I'm on record as saying that I agree with the fact that Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert never earned those deals. And I'm also on record as saying I don't really like the sort of nearly conflict of interest power play that LeBron plays with the movement of players within the team. Now, not with the clutch situation, but outside of that, let's say, we've seen that in years past. I mean, guys like Kobe Bryant have had that kind of leverage on their organizations.
Just ask Shaq.
That's not really outside of the realm of normal. Here's the thing. And here's, I think, where we differ, because it's basically a philosophical difference. It's not really a right or wrong. It's just more of a how you want to look at it. Do I think the Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert type of deals were bad deals? Yes, I absolutely think they were. I think, though, if LeBron wants to stick his hand in that fire and say, these are my guys and these are what we're going to pay them, and this is the team that I've built, a lot of people then say, if the team is performing badly, particularly those three guys, LeBron has no right to complain about it because he brought them there. That's where, to me, it ends. Because I think if you pay those guys that amount of money, then they have an implied responsibility to perform up to those expectations. Now, I realize they didn't earn that with the prior performance. We agree on that point. That's not what's in question. But moving forward, now, Tristan, you've inked this deal. JR, you've inked this deal. If you come in and you practice like a bum and you play like a bum and you just are a bum for the next 3 years, does LeBron James get to be upset with you for playing like garbage? In my opinion, yes, he does, because he had the role in getting you that money and getting you there to a team that was going to value it that. So you better bring that on the court. Other people say, no, LeBron can't be pissy about that. He can't be frustrated because it's his fault that they're there. That's where I differ. So, you know, it just goes back and forth. So when LeBron gets whiny and frustrated during the midpoint of a season, because it happens every year, that he's playing his butt off and the other guys are just dragging along, I understand that playing for a guy like LeBron James, playing for one of the greatest players of this era, is much the same as it would be for playing alongside a Kobe Bryant, playing alongside a Michael Jordan, playing alongside guys who are the best of their generation, hands down, without a question. There is going to be a second fiddle aspect to that role. That's why I give Scottie Pippen so much credit, because Scottie Pippen is probably one of the best forwards of all time alongside the best guard of all time. That's impressive. The fact that he was able to do that and keep his head on straight is very impressive. There certainly are guys that aren't willing to do that in this league and aren't willing to do that alongside LeBron James. And so with a leadership style that LeBron has, with the expectations he has, that's going to wear some guys out. Clearly, it wore Kyrie out, and clearly it was about to wear Isaiah out for the fact that the team, not just Isaiah, but a lot of those other guys we just mentioned, are not playing very well. And so Isaiah says, yeah, I don't want to be here, and I'm not going to put up with LeBron's crap because everyone's playing like crap.
And I think you're right to be able, look, I think where we differ is I don't believe that LeBron can't criticize those guys. I think he needs to, though, redirect his criticism at them and not at the Cavaliers organization. I think that's where we differ. If LeBron wants to talk about, you know, we're not getting the production that we need to out of our main guys, I think that's better criticism than basically blaming the Cavs organization and putting them on blast that, well, you know what, they haven't put enough playmakers around me. I think that's where we differ that, yeah, the reason is you should be blaming those guys. If they're your guys and your leadership style, and it doesn't have to be publicly, but you need to go to them and say, look, man, we need more from you. I need more than just, you know, 18 minutes a night and you getting 4 or 5 rebounds, Tristan. Like, you've got to figure out a way to stay on the court for 25 plus minutes, and you should be double-doubling every night and be a defensive force for us because we're getting killed on the inside. I think that is where, if LeBron was more of that aspect, I would have no problem with that. It's this notion that the Cavaliers don't do enough for me. They don't put enough around me. Thus, I'm only going to sign these 1+1 deals and always keep them on the hook. And at some point, Dan Gilbert looks at his books and says, you know what? We were $40 million backwards last year compared to the Los Angeles Lakers, who made $140 million. That's a $180 million swing, and neither one of us have a title. And all you do is make us feel like we're the bad guys. So I think we don't differ much on that. It's just that small point of, I feel like LeBron blames the Cavaliers too much and should put more on to the players, specifically ones that he vouched for more or less or helped to bring in. That's where I think that we differ at, that if LeBron's criticism was just redirected at the right people, I wouldn't have any problem with what he said. That's why I didn't have as much problem with what Isaiah said, because I felt his criticism was valid. If Ty Lue is not making good decisions, we don't know what goes on there. But if he feels like they come into a huddle and nothing is done, nothing has changed, then I feel like, yeah, he's probably feels like he has a voice to be able to, probably in his mind based on what he had done in the past, but from what he had basically done on this Cavaliers team, that's where I understand from your standpoint of, you know what? No, he really doesn't, because he didn't do anything. So a lot of times with these, especially these NBA, these long seasons, it's just these little minute differences of why people see things differently. And then when you have the LeBron haters and the LeBron love, everything gets built up to this much bigger thing than it really is. And a lot of times it just comes down to these small points. But I think LeBron makes himself look bad. Or like you said, he just kind of, every midseason, he just kind of goes to this point of complaining and pouting for a couple weeks. And then, like I said, all of a sudden, last Wednesday versus the Timberwolves, it was like he snapped out of it, and he's kind of been on a tear ever since then.
All valid points. I can't really argue that. The one thing I'll say as we wrap up the Cavs is that there are insiders, Windhorst being one of them, and like you said, he's built a 15-year career around covering LeBron James, but it's not just Windy who says this. It's some other guys, too, that, and here's the thing, we're looking at this with the public knowledge that we have. We don't know what's said behind closed doors between Dan Gilbert and LeBron James.
Do you even think they talk?
Well, I don't know, but look at what, I mean, Gilbert got rid of the GM that LeBron liked. I mean, so from the outside, the public view, you can say, yeah, Gilbert spends all this money and gives LeBron all the guys that he wants, but that's of what we know. We don't know maybe what LeBron has asked for behind closed doors that he's not getting, or you know what we don't even really know is if Tristan Thompson and J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert were actually the guys that LeBron wanted, or if it was like, well, I didn't get the three things I asked for first, and so now, or I'm going to tell you, Gilbert, that you're going to pay Tristan $80 million or I'm out of here. So we don't know how those conversations develop. I guess, you know, we form opinions based on the things we know that are out in public. But I like to give guys at least a little bit of the benefit of the doubt that when analysts and insiders are saying, neither side really trust each other that much, there has to be a lot of stuff that we also don't know. So when we're forming our public opinions about, well, LeBron's being a baby about this and look how much money Gilbert spent, we also don't know how much Gilbert says no to. So I take it with a grain of salt. But Justin, you brought up the Lakers. Let's wrap up this segment. It was a good segue into the fact that, like we said, Isaiah played a phenomenal first game with the Lakers. I think he, you know, maybe needed a fresh start too. So this deal, we think, might end up working out best for both teams in the short term as far as the rest of this year. It gets interesting after that. We only have a little bit of time left for segment one. Justin, I want to talk two things. Number one, Lonzo Ball has been out for a few weeks nursing an injury, and the Lakers are on a bit of a tear right now. They're rising up through the rankings. They're not that far out of the last playoff spot in the West. Now they have Isaiah come in, who plays the same position as Lonzo Ball. Isaiah plays great in his first game there. Now you've got two point guards there, not named Lonzo Ball, that are both playing really well right now. In your opinion, does that affect Lonzo's status on this team moving forward? And then aside from that, do you see any possibility that what the Cavs just did is potentially form a pathway to lose LeBron to the Lakers next year, which would be odd because Isaiah Thomas would be then on his way back out of LA, finding himself on a sixth team in 7 years or 8 years. So how do those two things look to you, at least on the face right now?
Well, it seems like the Lakers have no desire to keep Isaiah past this year. This whole deal with Cleveland, for their part, was all about dumping salary. How can we move salary to open up enough cap space, especially next year, for two max guys? So they get rid of Jordan Clarkson's $12.5 million off the books, and they get back an asset in a first-round pick from Cleveland. So they gain cap space and a first-round pick. That's all they cared about. It seems like they like Isaiah to sort of mentor Lonzo Ball, but I don't see that this being a long-term effect. Maybe in the short term of this year, how it's going to work, are they going to keep Isaiah coming off the bench and sort of help that second unit? We don't know how healthy Lonzo is going to be. I mean, hell, he's a less effective shooter than Isaiah, so I don't think they can play him on the floor at the same time together.
That's what I'm worried about, is it exposes Lonzo that this team actually can function better without him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you talked about it. I think they had won, what, 8 out of 10 before they lost to the Mavericks in Isaiah's debut, so they had been playing much better basketball. And again, I think for them, it's sort of getting rid of some of sort of the speculation that's been hovering over that team of, are they going to trade away Jordan Clarkson? Is Julius Randle a trade candidate? What are they going to do to move some of these salaries around? And it seems now that that team, that they've kind of gotten their rotation tightened up a little bit, they've played much better basketball, and it's just kind of come at a time when Lonzo's not been on the court. And we've talked about, Lonzo hasn't been that effective for them. He pops and flashes with a good game, you know, every 5-6 games. He throws up something close to a triple-double, but he's not a scoring threat for them. And you even see from a team like the Sixers with Ben Simmons, who's not a great outside shooter, he struggles when teams pack it in on him and they don't respect his jump shot, and you see it limits him at times. You see it's even worse with Lonzo. Teams just don't respect him, and I think it changes the way they play. Now you put guys like Josh Hart, who's been getting a lot of minutes. They've got Brandon Ingram running the point for him in sort of a trial and error type of situation, just
and he's
how
averaging
he does
17 points a game while he does that.
Yeah,
trial.
So he's been, they've just been playing better basketball. They've had a better rotation, a better feel to that team. So I don't know what the Lakers are trying to do, Eric. I don't know if they're trying to get into the playoffs or if they're trying to play for a lottery pick. That's what I just don't understand. So for Isaiah, I think for him, it's okay, let me come in here, let me sort of be a good soldier, let me fit in. Maybe it seemed like the Lakers, to get to your second point, they're not going to sign Isaiah back. They want all that cap space. They're going hard after LeBron. They're going to go after Paul George. If they miss on those guys, then maybe Isaiah's a candidate for a deal like we saw J.J. Redick get, or even the Lakers gave to Pope Caldwell, like a one-year, $18, $20 million. You play for us, that money comes off the books, and then, as was reported last week, the Lakers may be looking for 2019. Klay Thompson, Kawhi Leonard, some of those guys are going to come out. Obviously, Boogie Cousins is hurt this year. Do you really want to put a bunch of money in a guy coming off an Achilles injury? So maybe the Lakers do have to shift some focus. But look, I think it was a good deal for both teams. Now, does it open up a way? Yeah, but I think they could have opened that up anyways. Jordan Clarkson's a pretty good player, as we've seen now with his Cavaliers sort of first couple games with him, how good he's playing, especially his debut game where he looked good. The Cavaliers look faster. They look younger. like you said, they just look like a team that was happy to be playing basketball. So I think for them, it gives them a real shot, obviously, to come out of the East and contend this year. For the Lakers, it opens up all the cap space in the world they need next year to lure LeBron. And, hey, maybe LeBron's got an axe to grind with Isaiah, and he'll wave at him on his way into L.A. So it'll be interesting how that plays out coming up this year. But I think for both teams, they accomplished what they wanted to for this year. And for the Lakers, it accomplished what they wanted to next year.
Well, that's going to do it for the On the Court action. In segment two, we're going to head to the track. We'll talk about the upcoming Daytona 500 as previewed with what we saw in the Clash this past Sunday afternoon at Daytona International Raceway. So after this, it's going to be all racing in Daytona. NASCAR preview in segment two. Justin, one of my favorite times of the year is the middle of February because NASCAR racing comes to Daytona for the Daytona 500. The past few years have been some exciting races because of the aerodynamic packages that have been on these cars. NASCAR has tried a number of things over the past 10 years or so to get the plate racing right. Now, for our listeners who aren't that familiar with the terminology in racing, let us know your questions. We'd be happy to answer them for you. We don't want to leave you in the proverbial dust, if you will, on the track. We're happy to answer that, but we're just going to kind of talk through some of this stuff. Justin, the aerodynamic packages that I saw in the Clash this past Sunday were pretty exciting to me. However, I have a big concern about the safety of the drivers for this upcoming Daytona 500 due to the fact that the cars were very unstable when they get two and three wide. We've seen that in the past couple of years, that they want handling to be more of a focus at Daytona so that it's not just who can bump draft the best. And I think we've seen some pretty good racing when you get guys that need to get off the throttle a little bit in the corners. You need the back end of the car to loosen up a little bit so that they've got to actually drive that thing rather than holding the pedal wide open all the way around that 2.5 mile track. Here's the issue I see. Sunday's Clash featured 17 of the best drivers in the sport right now, and they were slip sliding sideways. I mean, I saw some of the most professional, most talented saves of race cars that I've ever seen. One of them, particularly from Kyle Larson. That was amazing. There was another one from Jimmy Johnson prior to the accident that happened that wasn't his fault. Jimmy Johnson saved a car that was almost completely sideways. I could see the number on the door as he was coming around the corner rather than the hood of the car. So, Justin, these are the 17 best drivers in the sport. On Sunday, this coming week, we're going to put 40 drivers total on the track. That means another 23 drivers out there slip sliding around. So, Justin, as we talk about this aerodynamics package, this weekend's race, the Daytona 500, are you nervous about the safety of these drivers? Are you nervous about the pack racing with how unstable these cars seem to be in the corners?
Well, yeah, I think you have to, when you watch that race and you see the way those cars were moving around, especially when they went to the camera shots inside the car, and you could just see like the cars in front of them, almost like when you're going down the highway and you sort of get behind someone, a tractor trailer, and you start to feel the air change, or you get behind someone even that's texting and they're all over the road. That seems to be what these cars want to do at 199 miles an hour. And so I think from that aspect, yeah, I do worry about what's going to happen in this race. But Eric, I think you're going to see in the 500 a lot of what you saw in the Clash, which is I think they're going to race hard early like they typically do. And either something's going to happen early or they're going to immediately get single file. And you're going to see, I believe 75% of the race Sunday is going to be a lot of single file. And guys are going to try, either they're going to drop to the back and form basically two different packs, or they're just going to run in one single file line for a good portion of this race because there's so much unknown. And there's a lot of young guys in there that don't have a lot of experience. This package has even changed. Like you said, it was tough for watching veterans try to control their car, much less if there's any type of wind or anything off of turn four that we sometimes see. And you bring all these young guys in with not a lot of experience. Eric Jones even talked about that in the pre-race that, hey, I don't have a lot of plate experience. Now you bring them in, you've changed the aerodynamic package. The cars are very unsettled. So I think it's going to get crazy the last 25 laps of the 500, but I can see a good chunk of this race, unfortunately, probably going single file, just because I think early on they're going to get out and they're going to kind of trial and error this thing and see how things work. And they're going to find these cars are super unstable. And if we want a chance to win, we got to be there at the end. And I think everyone will sort of get that mentality. But I wouldn't be surprised if they go crazy early in this thing, jockeying for positions, and you see a crash that takes out, you know, 10 plus cars, and that will definitely settle everybody down. But I think that's what you saw even in a 75 lap race. That these guys said, you know, the runs that we're getting on each other, and basically that's what you saw in the two wrecks that they had. I mean, Kurt Busch was 5-6 car lengths behind the one car, and he ran up on him so fast he couldn't miss him, and he wrecked him. And at the end, Larson had such a huge run down the backstretch, he just basically pow drove Jimmy Johnson and just wrecked him, just like you would see at a short track. So I think from that standpoint, you know, the dual races on Thursday, the evening after the pod drops, those are going to be some really interesting races as guys try to get more comfortable. Guys aren't going to want to tear up their primary car, but I think you could see some action happen there. Again, you got a lot of young guys. It only takes one mistake to wreck a good portion of the field. So unfortunately, I think that's probably what we're going to see Sunday. That's what I'm anticipating anyways.
You made a great point about the runs that these guys get. That was actually one of the most exciting things. I thought the Clash was a very exciting race as far as the action on the track, because being out front leading the race didn't mean a whole lot.
No.
You could pull down and then you could take off, get a 5 or 6 car run going, and it could happen in the matter of 2 to 3 seconds where you're closing that gap. And I think you're right. Larson, there's no way he meant to wreck Johnson like that. The other thing that we saw that was a bit of a concern is that Larson's driving a Chevy. And when he came up and closed that gap on Jimmy Johnson, I think he said, okay, I'm closing the gap this fast. I'll just bump the back of him and bump what they used to call bump drafting, and it'll be fine. They were not quite into turn 3 at that point when that happened.
They were still in the straightaway.
And so I think Larson honestly thought that he, even though he had a run going, he could slam the middle of the back of Jimmy Johnson's bumper like they always have, and they would both still be going in a straight line. What I'm hearing is that these new Chevy Camaros have a bit more of a point on the front, and I think they found out real quick that in a bump draft situation, those Camaros will push another car completely sideways. So that is something that they're going to have to get worked out. Justin, you brought up the duels. I used to really look forward to those duels, but here's why. They used to have 52, 53, 54 cars trying to get into what was then a 43-car field for the Daytona 500. And so you would have these two dual races that really mattered, because you would have guys or girls at that time transferring in and out of positions to actually race on Sunday in the Daytona 500. We basically no longer have that anymore. And so I think that will affect what we see on the track, because why risk tearing up your car and the cars of 8 other people to gain 2 spots in a starting rotation for the Daytona 500.
That doesn't even matter in a plate race.
Exactly. That doesn't even matter, because you're in the race anyway, and those 2 spots could be made up in the first half a lap of lap 1. And so I'm not disagreeing with you that I think, are they worth watching? Yeah, any race at Daytona is worth watching. I watched the ARCA race on Friday night at Daytona, and boy, they can tear some stuff up in that. But look, I don't think we're going to see as crazy of the duels as we used to, because they're all in. Like you said, jockeying for 2 or 3 spots when you're in the Daytona 500 anyway doesn't really matter. So let's transition that to the race on Sunday. Justin, give me your prediction. We always used to think the Toyotas had a pretty strong run the last few years at Daytona. Justin, there's only 5 Toyotas in NASCAR this year that really matter. And that's the 4 Joe Gibbs cars and then the Joe Gibbs satellite team driven by current champion Martin Truex Jr. So I don't know that Toyota is going to make a big play, at least by percentage. They don't have a lot of opportunity to make a big play in the Daytona 500. But if you had to pick 1 or 2 drivers that are going to win the Daytona 500 this Sunday, Justin, who do you like?
Well, boy, it's hard.
And I know that's impossible, by the way.
It's hard to bet against Brad Keselowski, as good of a plate driver as he has been. I would have to say I start thinking about this from a DraftKings standpoint and who I'm going to be targeting. Obviously, I was heavy on him. He was heavily owned in a short race on Sunday with only 17 cars, so the ownership will get more spread out and something like that coming up from a fantasy standpoint. But, I mean, he's so good at these races. The problem is guys can be so good, and something with outside of their making can take them out. That's what makes this race so hard to predict. So that's what you know, how this race will play out. I'm not as big of a fan of guys like Alex Bowman, William Byron, guys that have shown speed. I just feel like they're too young. And with this package, I feel like they can make mistakes. We saw Chase Elliott a couple years now in a row that he's gotten basically taken out. Some of his own doing, just getting loose off of four and tearing cars up.
He's going to take himself out. Did you see how he was racing in the Clash? I couldn't believe the places that he was putting his car.
He was a tad erratic. Same with Kyle Larson.
Unbelievable.
Kyle Larson's just a guy I feel like is just a dart with no feathers at these plate tracks where you just... He's so fast, but you saw it was like, all right, it's go time. And I mean, he was 20 miles an hour, looked like faster than Jimmy Johnson when he put the horn on him. So, you know, I really think, you know, Joey Logano, another guy usually very good at these races. And then, you know, the talk of Sunday was Denny Hamlin. So I think for me, it's probably right now just looking would be one of those three guys. But this race is so unpredictable. It only really takes one mistake to open it up where you get a potential underdog story like we saw a few years ago with Trevor Bayne jumping up and winning the race. So it's really more of putting yourself in the right place at the right time, avoiding the big wreck, making sure you have a good strategy for fuel mileage. And then at the end of the race, sometimes there's not enough cars left to really make big runs on you. So we saw that last year. Guys were dropping out of the race from fuel and... there was no one really left to catch Kurt at that point. That would be my standpoint. Do you have anybody different that you like?
No, I really don't. You took the two guys I would have picked. Brad Keselowski.
You weren't going to take Danica?
I could, because it's one of the races she's going to actually race this year. But no, I just don't feel like it's ever going to happen. And so I'm not going to do it. No, but I think Keselowski's a great pick. I think Denny Hamlin's a great pick. I think those are about as solid as you're going to get. If you wanted to think kind of, and I don't want to say next tier, that's certainly not next tier, but guys that you could name that I think have really a legitimate shot to win this race, you got to look at Kevin Harvick and look at a Jamie McMurray or a Ryan Newman. And only because it's just that they're really good plate drivers and they just seem to be there at the end. They might not impress you all race long. And then lo and behold, what? Ryan Newman's, you know, battling for the lead at Daytona. So you have that kind of thing happen. Real quick, Justin, I think dark horse for me is Paul Menard. Give me your dark horse.
You know what? I was just sitting there looking at that, and Paul Menard was a guy that popped out to me. I'm going to go with Eric Almirola. I really want to see what he does in that Stewart Haas car. He's a very underrated plate driver. I believe he won the Daytona race, one of them last year in the Xfinity Series, so he's shown that he can get it around there. My dark horse, I'll go with Almirola, but I love the Menard pick.
I do know this. There's going to be a lot of action on Sunday in the Daytona 500. It kicks off the 2018 season. It's a season that I'm kind of looking forward to because Martin Truex Jr. was a dominant force. I give him all the credit in the world for what he did last year. He certainly deserved to win that title. But now I'm ready to start over, see some new things, see some of these new drivers, these different teams, like a Hendrick Racing who has a lot of young blood coming in, and just make this sort of a different season moving forward. Hey, if Martin Truex Jr. dominates again, more power to him. We've certainly seen dominance from Jimmy Johnson for year over year in the past, but I think we're going to see a shakeup in the sport. I think it'll be good TV, a lot of good things to watch. That's going to do it for segment two. When we come back, it's going to be the lightning round. Justin, I'm going to keep this brief. My lightning round question for you is quite simple. Josh McDaniels, I'm not sure what games he's playing and how he thinks he's going to get an NFL head coaching job, but just give me your reaction, your gut reaction on the saga that is Josh McDaniels and what in the world he thinks he's trying to do to become a head coach in the NFL.
You and I struggled to even be able to talk about the whole McDaniels situation on the podcast because we felt there was so much uncertainty around it. We didn't want to put out false information because it kept going back and forth. The Colts like him. He's having second thoughts, even up to the Super Bowl. Well, he's got cold feet. He's having second thoughts. So I was shocked that Tuesday after the Super Bowl, when the news broke that McDaniels was in fact the Colts coach. And then it wasn't a few hours later, the alert came up on my phone that he's not taking the job. Look, everybody has the right to change their mind. I heard people trying to say, oh, this happened on signing day. It's just like when someone decommits to a college. No, those are 18-year-old kids that have a change of heart or something else happens. Or hell, in college, they probably got a better payday from someone else. But they're 18 years old. Josh McDaniels is 41 years old. He's a father. His dad was a lifer coach. He's got kids. He understands that there's a lot that goes into these jobs. And for him to take a job and bring other assistant coaches in, have the Colts hire them, have those guys leave their jobs, make their families move, I mean, it's just such a jerk move on his part to just so inconsiderate. And as a Bronco fan, having to deal with Josh McDaniels in his first coaching stint, it's just what you grow to expect from a guy like him. He's all about himself. He's never going to put anyone else above himself. So he's probably never going to be that great of a head coach, because I don't think he's going to be a leader of men. And I think that's what you saw in Denver, was he wore out his welcome very quickly. And now, like you said, his only coaching opportunity probably will be to one day maybe succeed Belichick, if that's part of the deal. He's saying it's not, but whatever was said in that room was enough to make him want to give up a head coaching spot to stay and be an offensive coordinator. So to me, I had no respect for Josh McDaniels before this whole incident. I have no respect for him. I have to believe that there's no NFL franchise outside of New England that has any respect for him as well. Hell, his own agent dropped him after this fiasco. So you can tell that no one wants to be attached to him. I feel bad for your Eagles. They end up losing their offensive coordinator. Good for him to be able to get his first head coaching job with the Colts and Frank Reich. But obviously for the Eagles, they lose a big cog in their offensive unit that they had. We talked about last week how great that unit ran. And obviously Peterson's the play caller, so I don't think for the Eagles standpoint it'll have that big of an impact. But again, when you have that kind of magic and have that kind of camaraderie among your offensive unit, especially in that quarterback room, you already lost DeFilippo. He's gone as well. So there's going to be some changes for your Eagles that they probably didn't even anticipate, especially coming off the Super Bowl when the news was out there. They were probably like, all right, our staff's going to stick together going into next year. And now kind of everything got changed for them. So again, what else do you expect from a Patriot but to come out and pull this kind of move? And maybe it was just a screw job on the Colts for turning them in for Deflategate. Maybe it was just a whole ruse the entire time to just put it to them, make them wait till everybody else was hired and they have to go out and get someone that, hey, maybe for the Colts it'll actually end up working out for the best for them. All right, Eric, my question for you is, it came out on Monday in an interview with Good Morning America. Johnny Manziel sat down, talked about his battles as being diagnosed as being a bipolar. Actually, that was a root of a lot of the issues that he seemed to have. So my question for you is, as he tries to get himself sober, maybe make a comeback, do you ever think there's a chance that he's going to play in the NFL again?
Wow, that's a great question. Look, from a human perspective, from a perspective of forgiveness and grace and what I believe the good Lord gives us, the ability to forgive and people who really honestly work hard to repent of the things that they've done wrong in their lives, I root for him in that respect. I think if he has come to the realization and come to the medical diagnosis that he's dealing with a disorder that certainly makes his character different in different situations and then makes him feel like two different people. And I get that. And I think that's a very serious thing. And I'm glad he's getting help for that, especially if that help includes keeping him off, drugs and alcohol and keeping him in an area that really, just as a human being, he's going to succeed more in life, whether it's in football or in another business. I would root for that, and I would be all for that. I would be happy if that all worked out for him and he was able to keep on a good path for himself and his girlfriend and maybe his future family if they decide to have kids. But the second half of your question was, do I think that changes his chances to be a quarterback in the NFL? And unfortunately, I really don't think that it does. The fact that Johnny Manziel was a failed attempt at a NFL quarterback really was no different than Tim Tebow or Robert Griffin III or some of these guys who have tremendous talent coming out of college and have shown a very good ability to play the game of football at the college level, and yet it just doesn't translate for one reason or another to the NFL level. That could be purely athletic based, not based on, his alcoholism or behavior or this bipolar disorder that he's been diagnosed with. And I think with Johnny Manziel, we're looking at an individual who's, as far as his stature, he's very small for a quarterback. So I don't think over the course of his career, he would even be able to stay healthy. He has some challenges due to his size, being able to see downfield, being able to make reads quickly and effectively because you know, quite frankly, I'm not even trying to be funny here, but he can't see above the guards and the tackles that are even in front of him. The game moves at a different pace than it did in college. And I think what he got away with in college, as far as just chucking the ball down the field and running around and scrambling, it looked great at Texas A&M. But I mean, quite honestly, Justin, you saw it. It looked like a mess at Cleveland. And I think it would have looked like a mess if he was on the Eagles or if he was on the Patriots. It's just not a style that works. Just like Tim Tebow's style didn't work. In order to have a quarterback like a Tebow, like an RG3, like a Johnny Manziel, you have to commit to that individual. You have to then build guards, tackles, a center, an entire system offensively around that style of football. And I'm going to tell you right now, quite frankly, no team in the NFL is going to do that for Johnny Manziel. It's just not going to happen. So look, as an individual, as a human being, if he's got this going and he's got his life pointed in the right direction, I am 100% rooting for him. I think that's fantastic. Will he be an NFL quarterback? In the lightning round question answer, as I'm sitting here right now, put on the spot, I'm going to say it's not going to happen. That's going to do it for episode 41. Justin, we are almost to season 2. I'm pretty excited about that. It's been a pretty successful season 1. Looking forward to all the sports action in the NBA, NASCAR, soon to be Major League Baseball, the NFL draft coming up. We keep reminding our listeners that just because the NFL is over doesn't mean we stop doing what we do every week. So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks for following us on Twitter at TalkBackFanTalk. Also on Instagram at TalkBackFanTalk. You can catch us individually. I'm at TalkBackEric.
And I'm at TalkBackJustin.
We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us your lightning round question ideas. Interact with us about the show. If you disagree with something I've said about LeBron James or NASCAR or NFL or anything, or you want to tell Justin that he's wrong about Isaiah Thomas or anything else, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we certainly hear from fans of different organizations throughout the weeks when we say something about, like you said, the Patriots or the Jaguars or the Steelers, different things throughout the NFL playoffs. We definitely get those
angry
tweets.
Fans.
We get angry fans. What are you talking about? And that's fine. I've even had PGA golfers yelling at me on this podcast. So who knows? As we get to the summer, we'll certainly look at the NFL previews for this upcoming season. Lots to talk about as players are recovering from injury. My guy Carson Wentz and others. So thanks for following us on social media and catching us each week, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, and everywhere that podcasts are popular around the country. Thanks for listening. I'm Eric.
I'm Justin.
Have a great week. We'll talk back at you next time.